Wisconsin didn't set up its own health insurance exchange under Obamacare. Wisconsin did not take more cash from Washington to expand Medicaid. The U.S. House repeal and replace bill gives Wisconsin officials new power over health care policy. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today he wants the Senate to pass its health care bill by July 4. What could all this mean for Wisconsin? For their analysis, I want to thank to my left Janet Zander, Public Policy Coordinator for the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources, John Peacock, Research Director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, and Tammy Jackson, a Public Policy Analyst with the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Thank you all for coming in. Nothing more important than healthcare policy affects all of us. But let's start with a baseline question. How did Wisconsin fare under Obamacare? Good, bad, just generally. I'd be interested in each of your impressions. How did Wisconsin do under Obamacare? Janet, you want to go first?
Sure. Well, it took a population of people aged 50 to 64 and cut in half the number of uninsured people. So prior to the Affordable Care Act, we had a rate of 15% for the uninsured among that population. Under the Affordable Care Act, we were at 8%. It also increased the solvency of Medicare. So we extended the Medicare Trust Fund, and it put in place some prevention programs under Medicare that were now available to people to help them stay healthy longer, which helped the Medicare budget and helped the Medicaid budget. So it was very good for older adults, in fact, and very good for older people.
John, your perspective, children and families?
Well, I think overall the Affordable Care Act has been a major success nationally and in Wisconsin. It certainly isn't perfect, but there have been huge gains across the country with 20 million fewer people being uninsured and about 200,000 fewer uninsured in Wisconsin. Plus, among others who formerly had insurance, we have much better access to preventative care than we did before. We no longer have to worry about changing jobs and finding ourselves in a position where we can't get health insurance because of pre-existing conditions. There are a huge number of very positive things that it did. Specifically with respect to kids and the uninsured rate for kids has come down a bit in Wisconsin. We've been a leader historically in that area. Under Obamacare, other states, as they expanded coverage for adults, for parents specifically, and more parents came in and got insured, more kids got insured in Medicaid at the same time. In Wisconsin, we've actually had a little bit of the opposite effect. Governor Walker and the legislature cut in half the Medicaid eligibility ceiling for parents, and as some of those parents dropped out, some of the kids lost coverage. So we have had, on net, there's been some gain in kids' coverage, but other states are starting to pass us by.
And Tammy, you work with those with disabilities. How did they fare under Obamacare?
Well, there's a number of really important protections that were part of Obamacare that were not in existence before. Namely, lifetime limits on how much an insurance company would pay for your overall Medicare costs. Obamacare removed that. There are no longer lifetime limits on the amount of coverage that you can receive. Extremely important for those folks who are facing a baby born in the NICU and staying there for 3 weeks. We definitely had folks with developmental disabilities, especially, that were reaching their lifetime limits within, you know, a month or two of their lives. The other big important protections were, of course, about pre-existing conditions. People with disabilities, either if they were born with them or they acquire them later on, that is a pre-existing condition. And prior to Obamacare, those folks could be charged a really different premium than say, somebody who did not have the same pre-existing condition. And I think the other piece that was really important with Obamacare is mandating that states all insurance plans cover 10 essential health benefits. I think it evened the playing field across states and across plans, and there are a lot of really important essential health benefits, including mental health services and substance abuse, maternal coverage, that weren't necessarily part of people's plans prior to to Obamacare. So for people with disabilities, those three things have really leveled the playing field on coverage and helped them have access to coverage where perhaps they would have either had to go into the Medicaid pool to receive services or perhaps be one of the folks that was participating in the high-risk pool.
So Wisconsin is healthier because of Obamacare. Now, thank you, John. We could spend time talking about how Obamacare could be fixed, but that would be counterproductive because there's no will in Washington to fix Obamacare. Instead, the U.S. House first couldn't pass its first version of repeal and replace, that's their term, and then it passed a version. So let's focus on the changes, the impact of Wisconsin. I realize we're a long way here, and let me just explain that. The U.S. House passed its version. The Senate is working in secret on its version. And this week, the president called the House-passed bill mean. So there's a lot of moving parts. None of us know how this is going to end up. But let's focus on the impact of Wisconsin under the House-passed bill. And I don't care who starts. I'd like to hear from all of you, but somebody jump in.
I'll jump in.
Thank you.
So the president's right. It is mean. I think a lot of people ought to agree on that. And it's why the process should be slowed down, and it should be done in the open. There hasn't been a single hearing on the bill.
Why is it mean?
It's mean for a number of reasons, but I think our biggest concern at the Council on Children and Families, and I think this holds for a lot of other advocacy groups, is the massive cut it's going to make in Medicaid. And the one kind of irony of that is that that's not even something that was part of the Affordable Care Act. This is new. And this is one of the reasons why it really ought to have public hearings, because this is brand new, that for the first time in the 50-plus year history of Medicaid, we're going to decouple growth in need for Medicaid services from the federal funding. Federal funding will no longer increase in direct proportion to growth in need if the state says, because of the opioid epidemic or some other epidemic, that we need to spend more in Medicaid. That's all going to fall on the state to do it because the federal funding is going to be capped. And those caps, they won't hit us right away, but gradually over time, is going to cause a massive cut. According to the Congressional Budget Office, over a 10-year period of time, there'd be an $824 billion cut in Medicaid funding for the states. And that would be, in the 10th year, a 25% cut. Then what's particularly worrisome about it, though, is that it probably wouldn't stop there. Once Congress says that this is not a guarantee of funding that will grow with need, then they're going to keep coming back and cutting more. And the president's budget illustrates that because he takes it from a $800 billion cut over 10 years to a $1.3 trillion cut, which in year 10 would be 45%. That's going to force states to ration Medicaid services and eligibility.
Well, just to provide some context on Medicaid, yesterday I did tape an interview with the Medicaid director, Mr. Heifetz. Medicaid in Wisconsin hit $9 billion last year, and the May caseload, 1,187,000 people, one out of every five Wisconsin residents get some health care. And you have a growing, it's been called unsustainable cost of Medicaid. And the director yesterday said that interview is on wisconsin.org. So Medicaid is a huge part of health care in Wisconsin. And you're saying, John, it would the House-passed bill would dial it back, not by 800, but 1.3 trillion over a 10-year period?
That's under the Trump bill.
The Trump budget plus
combined
the House.
Yes.
Okay. Now, but you can talk about the House-passed bill in two ways, Medicaid and then the impact on people who are not on Medicaid. So should we move to address that? Who wants to go first on that issue?
This is the American Health Care Act really hurts older people, poor people, and sick people, who are the people who most need health insurance, right? And it does that in a variety of ways. It does that by raising the age rating caps. So under the Affordable Care Act, insurers were restricted to not charging younger people or older people any more than three times higher than a younger person.
Yes. Under the theory there is that older people are more prone to higher health care costs.
Absolutely.
Excuse me, but let's go back to the ratio. 3 to 1.
Yep.
Okay, excuse me.
Yep.
Go
so,
ahead, Jen.
So we knew that they were going to be more expensive, but they said 3 to 1 is enough. Under the American Health Care Act, they can charge up, they can charge 5 times more or even apply to charge more than that. So that's going to raise their premiums a lot. The other thing it does is change how the subsidies are provided. They're going to be provided by age and not income. Under the Affordable Care Act, lower income people get larger subsidies. Now that's going to be based on age, but the subsidy that's available won't make up for the fact that you will be charged more because you're older, and you'll be charged more, because of your health care, and you'll be charged more because you have pre-existing conditions. And we do know that the older you are, the more likely you are to have pre-existing conditions. So your health care costs will go far higher than whatever subsidy you will be receiving. So it's a significant problem. It also doesn't take into account what area you live in and what the health care costs are in that area. So, I mean, it compounds this problem over and over and over again in terms of who's going to be most vulnerable under this plan.
Tammy, you referred to the basic benefits guarantee package. Now, doesn't the House pass bill allow states to dial back those benefits? Do I have this right?
You absolutely do.
Okay.
In a number of ways, again, in kind of 3 separate ways. As it's written now, the House will just take the Obamacare piece, first of all.
Okay.
It would allow states to essentially decide whether or not to cover the same 10 essential health care benefits that I talked about before.
Okay.
So, you may have a state that chooses to continue carrying all of them. You may have a state that says you don't have to carry any of them, insurance plans, or some pick and choose of some set of benefits.
It would give states the right, assuming it becomes law, of getting rid of all 10 basic benefits?
Mm-hmm.
All 10?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it wouldn't keep a core.
That's right.
Okay, thank
That's
you.
Right.
Excuse
That's
me.
The
Go
waiver.
Ahead.
You know, the states are applying for a waiver, and they
mental
can
health, substance abuse treatment. I mean,
some pretty big, important things.
Some
pretty big things that were real accomplishments of the Obamacare law. So that means a couple of things. One, we're going if you live in a state where they've decided to waive some combination of benefits, that means your insurance plan, whether or not you're in Medicaid or in a private sector plan or purchasing your own insurance a la carte, doesn't have to cover the same things. And it may mean that if you lived in another state, they would. So again, you're kind of making a differential in terms of premiums and what the coverage actually is. So that's the first piece. The second piece, states, and you may have to help me a little bit on this, states would be able to, again, waive, I'll take the Medicaid piece. They also would have to decide, what sets of benefits they cover under traditional Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the cut, both in dollars that John was talking about, but also this idea of a per capita cap, which sets a value by which you have to fit all of the costs of care a person needs into the same box. Many states will have to decide things like, do we have our current Medicaid program? Do we cover all of the same benefits? Do we eliminate certain services? Do we reduce those services? Do we cover the same kinds of people in children, people with disabilities, older adults, people who are working? And states will have the ability to decide some pretty big things about their Medicaid programs.
And this is especially relevant because, correct me if I'm wrong, Wisconsin is one of the states that provides all or almost all of the benefits under Medicaid. Is that right?
Yes.
We have used the flexibility within Medicaid.
That's policy that's built up over decades.
Yes. Yeah.
Wisconsin has chosen to have what's been called a generous Medicaid program. Now, we can agree or disagree on whether that's, but we provide most of the benefits that the law says you can provide.
That's true.
Because we have proven that the waivers Wisconsin has applied for are cost neutral or better, and so we've done a really good job in Wisconsin of providing more benefits at less cost.
It's a waiver that got a senior care, isn't it?
Right, senior care, and we provide
care. Iris.
Yes, home and community-based services.
I respect, I self-direct, Iris. Yeah. Yes.
And transportation services, things that other states are asking for waivers to not provide anymore. But we have shown in Wisconsin, these are smart things to provide because in the long run, they save our budget money.
So when the federal government potentially cuts Medicaid spending by $1.3 trillion, including the president's budget and the House-passed bill, states like Wisconsin will have to say, can we continue to provide service X, Y, and Z, correct?
And I think the big piece for people
at what expense?
Disabilities, especially, I think of it as like packing a suitcase. You know, you're going on a trip, you got to fit everything into your suitcase that you're going to take. Well, there's only so many things you can fit into the suitcase. You can rearrange some stuff, you can make some things smaller, but at some point you have to start taking things out of that suitcase. And for people with disabilities, the biggest fear that they have is that the federal law requires some very expensive things states have to pay for. They're called mandatory federal Medicaid services. One of those, probably one of the biggest costs, is institutional care. Our state developmental disability centers, our nursing homes, these are things that have higher fixed costs that are going to take up
the most expensive care.
Most expensive care that will take up the most room in our suitcase. And we have spent in Wisconsin the last 25 years saying it is better for us to invest in things like family care and IRIS and home and community-based services because it costs us 30% to 40% less for folks to live in their community and keep them in their own homes and out of institutions. The real fear for people with disabilities is that a per capita cap that still requires the same expensive mandatory services states have to provide will leave less and less space in our suitcase for the most things that are most cost effective in the long run and are actually what people want. And they're the items like employment services, like transportation, that really get people to be part of the community and part of the workforce that are going to end up getting squeezed at the expense of where we were 50 years ago.
But when I listen to the news shows and I hear Republicans in the U.S. House who voted for this bill, they say, yes, but we're lowering premiums. When you dial back some of these services, does that, and the basic guarantee of benefits, is that going to lower premiums? Is that why they're saying that it's going to lower premiums?
I think we're talking, what you're hearing about is the folks that are purchasing insurance on the
private market
Obamacare exchanges.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The changes that John is describing to traditional Medicaid, and in Wisconsin that means about 20 different Medicaid programs, Badger Care Plus, and everybody who uses services on the Forward Health Card, those aren't part of Obamacare. That exists in this state right now.
Yes.
The state is basically matching with the federal government and covering those costs. The federal government's providing us almost 60% of whatever it costs to provide that care.
And that would go down with this 1.3 potential trillion cut. Excuse me again for interrupting.
Yeah. And in fact, that relationship of matching where the federal government provides a set percentage of the funding goes away under a per capita cut. So no matter what your costs are, if the federal government will only give you the same lump contribution, and then the question becomes, how do you reconcile in a bill that does not have cost controls in a place where two-thirds of the people who are in our Medicaid programs are older adults and people with disabilities? That's where two-thirds of the spending is. And that's where we pay for long-term care in this country is really through Medicaid. There gets to be a point where you're going to have to start taking things out of that suitcase. And you're either taking away populations of people, you're dialing down what those benefits are, or you're restricting, how much people get, or you're deciding that you're not going to do certain things.
But I appreciate what you were saying about the folks, though, outside of Medicaid as well, because that is true. The way that people will get into these new marketplace plans, the way they'll be drawn in is by lowering the premiums, by lowering what coverage you get.
You get rid of the mandate that everyone must have coverage.
Right.
But then the premium structure is more likely to invite someone 25, 28 to buy it because the premiums are lower than the person over 50 who, as you said, Janet, is going to be penalized.
Correct.
Significantly, with up to five times.
However, which one of us has the crystal ball that tells us, who am I feeling lucky? Am I going to be healthy? Am I not going to have an accident? Am I not going to have a high-risk pregnancy? Am I not going to have a whatever it may be? Mm-hmm. When we purchase that plan that no longer covers all those things or has caps on our on whatever coverage we're going to get. I mean, those are things we don't know, and we heard some horrible stories prior to the Affordable Care Act of people who thought they were going to have one of those good years and didn't, and of people of all ages, I might add. So it's a significant problem, and we know that the high-risk pools didn't cover a lot of people, particularly those who had pre-existing conditions for 6 months. Well, you know, at that point in time, you know, you've paid a lot of money out of pocket, and the bankruptcy rates for medical issues were sky high. And so we're looking at some significant, not only personal trauma, but financial out-of-pocket costs, which is money people don't have, which is why they get drawn to those lower-cost plans to begin with.
I want to go to high-risk pools, but John's been very patient. He's been trying to get in twice.
I'll weigh in on that issue about the marketplace first, and then want to go back to Medicaid. On the marketplace, I mean, the House plan provides a whole lot less money for the new tax credits, and that money isn't going to be targeted nearly as well. It's not going to be targeted based on income, and eligibility for the new tax credits is unlimited. There's no longer an income ceiling on it. So the tax credits have to get spread a lot further. That creates problems for the marketplace that the CBO says will help destabilize the marketplace to some extent, because especially because the premium tax credits will no longer increase in areas where the costs are higher. So you have a lot of people with higher cost plans that are just going to say it's not worth it. And that's going to be more true of healthier people than it is for sicker people who need the coverage more. So you get what's called adverse selection, mm-hmm. with and that destabilizes the market. So there's some real problems there in the structure of the whole thing. But I wanted to go back to what you were saying about Wisconsin being pretty generous, and we are generous in what we cover in Medicaid. We don't always make it easy for people to get everything like dental care and mental health care that's covered, but we do have that aside generous benefits. But notwithstanding that, the problem that this bill causes for us is that even though we have pretty generous benefits, when you compare our spending per enrollee relative to other states, new data that just came out this week, which is from 2014, indicates that for kids, we're the second lowest of all the states in spending per child in Medicaid. For people with disabilities, we're fourth lowest among all the states. For seniors and other adults, we're around 10 or 11th lowest. What the House bill does is, in perpetuity, we're going to get reimbursed based on being at the bottom. And so Wisconsin is penalized permanently for being efficient in how we've delivered services and for being a leader, like in deinstitutionalization. We've saved a lot of money, shown the way for some other states. They can now come along and follow our lead on that kind of thing and get way more money for the same basic services that we're providing.
Well, let's turn the issue of turn to the issue of pre-existing conditions. Now, the argument is, well, correct me if I'm wrong, that someone with a pre-existing condition could go into a high-risk pool. Now, we had, until Obamacare repealed it, a high-risk pool. I did some work on it, and it needed to be tweaked and fixed, but when it was repealed, there was some amount of consensus that it was working pretty well. So when people in Washington, elected officials, say, yes, but we're putting X amount, X billions into a high-risk stability pool, what's the other side of that story?
So at its peak, I think our high-risk pool served about 21,000 people.
And compare that to our Medicaid caseload of 1,187,000.
Yeah, well, and compare that to the fact that at the time there were over 500,000 uninsured Wisconsinites. So, I mean, I commend the people who worked on our high-risk pool. Wisconsin had one of the best and one of the largest relative to the size of the state. We did a good job. But the fact that ours was one of the best, that should scare anybody who's saying that this is a solution. because it was just a drop in the bucket in terms of meeting the need. And there was, it was relatively expensive. It provided limited benefits. There was a waiting list to get in. And you were ineligible if you had any offer of employer-sponsored coverage, no matter how unaffordable that might be, which is actually an aspect of the House plan as well. So there were lots and lots of problems.
When the House plan, reading from the summary that you were good enough to send me, Janet, the Patient and State Stability Fund, $15 billion in 2018 and 2019, $10 billion each year for the following 8 years to, among other things, establish state high-risk pools. Is that enough? Or do we not know?
I think we would be gazing into the crystal ball, but I think the consensus is that when Obamacare came along and we were transferring from high-risk pools to general coverage for pre-existing conditions and other things, they had, I think, an $8 billion account set up, and it ran dry, like, very quickly. It did not cover the actual costs of what it maintained for the existing high-risk pools, and as John said, the high-risk pools that we had before did not cover everyone who needed it. I would also point out that, you know, high-risk pools back before Obamacare are actually not taking into context the things that Obamacare put in place to resolve some of the issues that we had that created the necessity for high-risk pools. And for people with developmental disabilities and disabilities in general, a lot of them either couldn't get the coverage that they needed on the private market at all, you know, the services weren't there or they weren't there in the right duration. Those folks couldn't even make it to a high-risk pool. They had to basically sit down and be in, and remain in Medicaid. So, you know, this idea that there was mobility, you know, that just wasn't true.
The issue of the older you are, the more you'd pay, Janet, your point.
Mm-hmm.
This is especially relevant as Wisconsin becomes one of our older states.
Right. We're an aging population.
That's right. That's a huge issue.
So this formula that they're talking about, basing on your costs in 2016, take a look at a population where our boomers are mostly in, you know, the upper end of that boomers are in that 65 range. By the, you know, we're looking at a point 10 years from now where we're starting to get more of the boomers into that 80 age range. We're going to increase the likelihood that they're going to be needing long-term care costs, and their health care and long-term care costs are going to be higher. It doesn't reflect that.
Those are the most expensive patients.
Absolutely.
Right. What about the disparity? Is there a potential disparity in the House passed plan in Wisconsin's urban areas, which have, even though they're high-priced, health care, and rural areas, which are in some areas are medically underserved, I think is the term. So any thoughts on what the House passed bill, any implications on the rural-urban disparity? Would it worsen it?
There's recently been, I believe it's a study from Georgetown that examined exactly that issue. And again, the consensus is that rural areas do not fare as well under the House plan. And there's a variety of reasons for that. First of all, rural areas tend to have more people with disabilities and older adults.
Yes.
So again, two of your higher cost populations that are in those areas, they also tend to have more people who are served by Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
because they're also lower income. So when you look at, say, rural health care and how hospitals are, you know, we forget that it isn't only, you know, the participants who are in Medicaid. Medicaid actually pays, you know, hospitals and a variety of different kinds of professional care providers. It's a reimbursement system. So rural hospitals who have a higher population of Medicaid patients stand to get lower reimbursements potentially as states have to figure out, do I cut services, do I cut reimbursement rates, do I
right.
cover the same number of people? You know, there really are a very small set of options for states if they are in the place where they need to lower Medicaid costs.
And that chart that I saw, which counties, which regions of Wisconsin, its residents got most often turned to healthcare.gov to buy their health care? Sean Duffy's district, Ron Kind district, northern and western Wisconsin. John, you were going to say?
Well, yeah, related to that, in rural areas of the state, you have fewer large employers that provide employer-sponsored insurance. You have more self-employed people, and generally somewhat lower than average incomes. And so there are more people who need individual coverage, who need to go to the marketplace, a higher percentage of people who are eligible for the subsidies in the marketplace. And so you have stronger marketplace participation in that Obamacare marketplace, subsidized marketplace in those rural parts of the state. But also we put out something recently where we looked at enrollment of kids in Medicaid, and I think a lot of people would guess that that's higher in urban areas. Among the 20 counties with the highest percentage of kids participating in Medicaid, 19 of the 20, Milwaukee and 19, but is one somewhere in the top 10, but the 19 are in the northern third of the state. And so you have a lot of low-income people who rely on Medicaid and on the Obamacare market.
The Medicaid director reminded me yesterday that our May caseload was 1,187,000. 400,000 of that were kids on Medicaid.
Yeah.
And you're saying quite a number of them?
Actually.
Okay. We're almost out of time. So is there any other thoughts that you want to bring forth the potential impact on Wisconsin of the major healthcare debate in Washington going on? And if not, here's maybe a final question. When the Senate does come out with its plan, what are you going to look for in terms of potential impacts on Wisconsin? Janet.
I want to look at how does it impact the Medicare population. We know that the current bill impacts both the younger, older adults, that 50 to 64-year-old, but it also has a significant impact because of the eliminates a suite of taxes, that including a tax on the upper income, the over 250,000 Medicare beneficiaries, that will impact the solvency of Medicare. So, you know, there's nobody that's not impacted by this American Healthcare Act. So I want to look at what it's going to do for Medicare beneficiaries and those younger, older adults.
John.
I'll be looking pretty much at one thing, and I fear that I know what the answer is going to be if they pass it, but I hope they prove me wrong. I'm going to be looking at, does it change the fundamental structure of Medicaid? Does it decouple federal funding from growth in need? And I fear that it will, and that will be a huge step backwards.
Tammy, on behalf of those with disabilities?
I'm going to be looking for some similar things to John. I'm going to really be looking at what are those per capita caps, what is the funding level that you're setting at, and how are you calculating it? Because as Janet so deftly pointed out before, you know, once Congress makes that switch, then you could come back and end up making that, you know, tweaking how that money comes into the state. I'm also going to be looking at what are the options for states once we know what the magnitude of a funding reduction is and what the per capita cap is. Because as I said, states have very few options. They're either eliminating or reducing services. We're going back to wait lists, which is undoing a lot of what this state has really worked very hard to achieve. Or they're cutting provider rates, which of course, if you don't have people who are working in the community and doing all of the services like personal care that people with disabilities need, then you're looking at if you can't live in the community, where do you go? And that would be institutions.
We're out of time, but I want to go into overtime for one very quick subject. Any thoughts on the governor's waiver that would allow them to drug screen and drug test and work requirement, 40 hours of job training, 80 hours a month, the childless adults, the 149,000 childless adults on Medicaid. Quick thoughts on that. Wise, punitive, what?
I think it's just a wasteful use of state resources, because we're going to end up spending a whole lot of money on things like screening and testing and administrative red tape that we ought to be spending. If our goal is really to increase the size of the Wisconsin workforce, which is what he says wants to do.
That's what Mr. Heifetz told me.
We should be putting every dollar of that, or nearly all of it, into expanding access to drug treatment programs. We know that there are way more people who need drug treatment than can get it right now. We've got to use that money to bring down those waiting lists rather than using that money to increase the size of those waiting lists.
What our organization did provide the Department of Health Services with some public comments on their waiver. What I always like to remind folks is that our able-bodied Medicaid population is really not as able-bodied as you think. And there's four core populations of people with disabilities in Badger Care Plus. If you have a primary diagnosis of mental health care, if you have a developmental or intellectual disability and you do not meet the functional screen to get into one of our long-term care programs, if you are a person with an intermittent disability such as multiple sclerosis or something that flares up and impedes your ability to work on occasion, or if you are a person who is simply in that two-year and sometimes longer waiting period to get a disability determinants from SSDI, you are probably in the able-bodied Medicaid population. And I think that, you know, from our perspective, you know, the ability for the department to kind of sift and winnow and figure out who needs a medical exemption and who should be required to work what level of hours gets very complicated very quickly. When you kind of have everybody in one bucket, the able-bodied Medicaid population really is pretty diverse, and it includes a lot of people that have some significant barriers.
Janet, do you want the last word on the waiver?
I will say we know that waiver doesn't apply to the population we most work with, but I struggle with anything that stigmatizes people who need public benefits, because we're always challenged with helping people accept a public benefit when they really need one because of the stigmas often attached to them.
Very good. Thank you. I want to thank Janet Zander. I want to thank John Peacock and Tammy Jackson for coming in to talk about this critical issue. Maybe once we know what is finally signed into law and we have some time to analysis, maybe we should reconvene, okay?
Definitely.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.